Good afternoon, everybody. My name is David Axelman. I'm with the Tallahassee Lawyers Chapter, and I have the privilege of introducing the moderator for our next panel. Before I do so, I've been asked to announce that we have been approved for 5 credits of CJE for all the judges here. 5 credits. All right, in the 15 seconds I've been allotted to introduce our moderator, Judge Ann Lee Gaylord Moe was appointed to the 13th Circuit in 2017 by then Governor Rick Scott. Prior to that, she was an AV-rated commercial litigator, an equity shareholder at Bush Ross in Tampa, a law clerk to U.S. District Judge Virginia Covington, and during law school was editor-in-chief of the Law Review. She serves in the Civil Division. Please join me in welcoming Judge Moe.
Thank you, everyone. He did that quickly because I told everybody that we wanted to do introductions very quickly so that we could spend as much time as possible talking about your Constitution today. So we're going to streamline our bios. I do want you to know that although I'm going to streamline the bios and read them quickly, all these people deserve your attention on the website. Go look at their full bio. They're all super impressive. So. We're going to start with Anastasia Bowden, is the director of the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. She's a recovering litigator, having spent the decade before joining Cato at the Pacific Legal Foundation, where she led the organization's equality and opportunity practice. She is co-creator of the podcast DIST, where she tells the stories behind infamous Supreme Court dissents. The next up is someone who maybe you've heard of before. His name is Alan Lawson. He was an AV-rated civil litigator prior to his appointment to the circuit bench in 2002. His 21-year judicial career was capped by his appointment to the Florida Supreme Court by Governor Rick Scott in 2016. He retired from the bench in late 2022 and is now practicing law as a founding shareholder of a law firm called Lawson Huck Gonzalez, which you also may have heard of before. So next is Jonathan Marshfield. Professor Marshfield is an associate professor of law at the University of Florida, the Levin College of Law. His research focuses on state constitutional law and theories of constitutional change. It's just a light topic. Next we have Solicitor General Henry Whitaker. He's listed as Dan Bell, but today you're gonna be Henry Whitaker, right? That's
every
the
day,
plan.
Every day
you're going to be Henry Whitaker. Okay. So he's Henry Whitaker, even though he's listed as Dan Bell. He became Florida's Solicitor General in July of 2021. He came to the position after serving in the Office of Legal Counsel of the United States Department of Justice, including as Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General, where he advised the White House Counsel's Office, the Attorney General, and Cabinet Secretaries on a range of constitutional and statutory questions. Before that, Solicitor General Whitaker worked on the appellate staff of the Civil Division of the United States Department of Justice. He clerked for Clarence Thomas, Justice Clarence Thomas of the United States Supreme Court, you might have heard of him, and for Judge David B. Sentell of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. So the panel and I have had some communication prior to today, but you're a recent addition, and I just wanted you to know that I'm happy you're here. And after I read a little bit more about you, I can see that you've got a lot going for you, Henry. And if this whole thing with the Solicitor General thing doesn't work out, you're welcome to come be my intern after this.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
So
I've really been looking for somebody like you.
Yes. So, so the first thing we're going to do is lay the foundation. Justice Lawson, could you spend a minute sort of explaining to everyone what they need to know as an overview to understand our topic today?
Okay. So your Constitution has 5 ways that it can be amended. There is the legislature, by a supermajority vote of both houses, the legislature can put something on the ballot that changes the entire Constitution. They can propose a new constitution or any measure. And then there is the Citizens Initiative, the one that we're going to talk about today. And it differs from the legislature significantly in that the Constitution has a single subject provision that relates to that. So the Citizens Initiative can only propose a change to the Constitution that represents a single subject and matters directly connected therewith. And so a lot of the litigation when it comes to citizen initiatives has to do with that. Is it more than one subject and matters directly connected therewith? And then the other thing that distinguishes that, before I get to the other three and just mention them, is that with any other way that something amendment gets to the voters, the challenge has to be within 30 days after filed with the Secretary of State, but the challenge starts in circuit court with everything else. There's a provision in the Florida Constitution that says the Attorney General shall, as provided by general law, have the Florida Supreme Court review every citizen initiative petition. And so that's what happens with those. There's not necessarily a challenge with other provisions. There frequently is, but it starts in circuit court, and then frequently we'll get pretty quickly to the Supreme Court because of the provision in the Florida Constitution that allows DCAs to certify a question to the Supreme Court that requires immediate resolution. And because of the time frames with the ballot initiative, the citizens initiative, the Supreme Court, once the case gets filed, they have to decide that case by April before the general election. So it's the one kind of case where the court has a deadline. Otherwise, I'm now in private practice and have deadlines all the time. It's maddening to have all these deadlines. Oh my gosh, because the only deadline I had really was that citizens initiative petition before in deciding those cases. You have a constitutional revision commission, and we went through that process. It's every 20 years. The next one's 2037, and interestingly, I think there's 37 members of the Constitutional Revision Commission. Those are appointed by the governor, 15, each legislative body, 9, and then there are a couple more appointments. The Supreme Court has 3. And then there is the Tax and Budget Reform Commission, which is also every 20 years and in between. So it's 10 years Tax and Budget Reform Commission, 10 years Constitutional Revision Commission. And then the last one, the citizens also have a similar right by getting signatures in all of these, all the counties, to call for a constitutional revision commission, a constitutional convention. And the constitutional convention is interesting. It's a smaller group of people. They're appointments by the governor, smaller group, appointments by the House and Senate. But the House and Senate cannot appoint any member or anybody who's elected to start in the House or Senate during the term of the convention. So that's the basic structure. The law is pretty simple and straightforward. When it comes to the initiatives, which we're talking about today, there's a single subject requirement. The court looks at that. The court does not look at the constitutionality of the measure. The court does not look at is whether it's a good idea or not, and it's interesting, in a lot of the cases that I saw at the Supreme Court, folks are arguing policy in cases where we don't decide policy. That frequently happens, and you'll see that. I saw that in the Citizens Initiative. People were arguing why it was a good idea or a bad idea, and they can file whatever they want, but that's not relevant to any legal decision that the court has to make. The statute that governs says that the ballot summary has to be 75 words, and it has to concisely explain the chief purpose of the measure. And so, and then the case law is that it can't be misleading. The ballot summary cannot be misleading. And that is the primary protection from citizens putting something on and sort of and duping the public into adopting something into their constitution that they did not intend. And so what you have in these cases, very simple, straightforward, is that you have an argument over whether an initiative is a single subject, whether it's misleading. I haven't seen one yet where they missed it on the 75 words, so that's not been an issue. So is it misleading? And that is the general overview of how the process works. It works pretty quickly, even where there's not a deadline, that April deadline. The court understands that you know, you really have to decide that case so that something doesn't get stricken after it's been voted on, and so you don't want something on the ballot if possible. So I know the whole time I was on the court, there was a real sense of urgency in priority for those cases to make sure that occurred. So that's an overview.
Thank you, Solicitor General. At this point, we're going to do just kind of some openings, and you get to go first. And I think if you could talk a little bit about the practitioner's perspective in these types of cases, that'd be helpful, but also whatever else you want to talk about.
Sure. Thanks for having me. My deputy, Daniel Bell, was supposed to be here. I was the second choice, so you're stuck with me. I'm a little bit limited in what I can say. We have, I'm handling, two big initiative cases that are before the Florida Supreme Court, but I'll just sort of talk more generally about the process, I guess, as I see it. So, as Justice Lawson indicated, I mean, the requirement that we really tend to focus on in our practice is the requirement that's been explicated in Florida case law, that the ballot summary not be misleading. And that's actually a pretty important, given the way that the initiative process is structured in Florida, because the thing that is actually before the voters is the ballot summary. That's what they see in the ballot box. And you can have amendments that are extremely complex at times, lengthy amendments. The ballot summary's still got to be 75 words. And I think the idea is like, look, when you have, lay people who are making big decisions about big policy, you kind of got to boil it down. And that makes it, I think, essential if the voters are going to have an informed choice about how to amend Florida's governing charter, that the ballot language not be misleading, which can be a tall task given the length and complexity of many of these amendments. And the standard that the legislature has set out to govern those amendments, 101.161 in the Florida statutes, is, I think, appropriately demanding. It requires that the ballot language be printed in clear and unambiguous language, which is the language from which the misleading, that it not be misleading, be derived. And I think that vigilant policing of that requirement is essential for the voter's choice to be meaningful, because I don't think that the Democratic choice is not worth very much if the voters don't know or don't understand what they are voting on. Another aspect of the process I think that is also important, that's reflected, that needs to be in the ballot summary, and Florida Supreme Court has explicated this requirement in other cases, is, and Justice Lawson mentioned, that the chief purpose of the measure has to appear in the ballot language, and that goes even a little bit beyond the requirement that the language not be misleading. Misleading is sort of, is it accurate? Does it accurately describe what the amendment does? But there's also this doctrine, and I think this perhaps may become more important going forward, is a requirement that if there's something really, really, really important about the amendment that voters should know about but the ballot summary doesn't disclose, that is another limitation. I think that's derived probably from the chief purpose language in the Florida statute. I mean, the way the Florida Supreme Court has put it is that a ballot summary cannot fly under false flags. So you have to not just be accurate, but you also have to explain what the main things, the main principal effects of what this amendment is going to be. And I think that's another aspect, important aspect of this. Again, if the choice is going to be meaningful, the voters have to understand what they're voting on.
Okay. I'm going to follow up at some point with you on one thing that you said, but I'm going to give you a minute to think about it because I didn't float it to you in advance. But there's an article out there by Randy Barnett, maybe. He talks about the difference between interpretation and construction, the difference between something that is ambiguous and something that's vague. And he discusses that the word ambiguous means something that has more than one meaning, where the word vague is something that could apply to multiple different circumstances. So think on that and see if you have anything that you're allowed to say on that point. I know that you have some limitations, but I'm going to come back to you on that point, okay?
Sure.
Justice Lawson. Openings.
My opening was my introduction. So
well, then we're ahead of schedule. Yes, that's great. Okay, Professor Marshfield.
Thank you. So it's really great to be here. I guess I should begin with a bit of a disclosure that I am a recent Florida transplant, and so I'm getting up to speed on my Florida constitutional history, my Florida constitutional doctrine. But to the extent that I have a viewpoint that can be valuable to this discussion, I study, and for a while now, I have studied state constitutional change across states and across time, and trying to understand some of the broader trends across all of the United States that characterize how states deal with their constitutions and how they handle pressures for change. And so I, for this panel, have tried to think a little bit about where and how I would situate Florida within the context of some of these broader themes that we see across states, especially across other states that have the initiative. And so I guess two things really jump out to me when I start to take a closer look at Florida in light of those broader themes. The first is that I do not think Florida's experience with the initiative in particular is representative. It is not the norm for a few different reasons, both in terms of history and then also in terms of function, both historically and, as I understand the doctrine, presently. So in many initiative states, actually most initiative states, the initiative was initially adopted in the progressive era at the end of the century, into the 20th century, into the 19th century, into the 20th century. And in addition to that, in a lot of states, it was the product of some really intense popular political movements. In many instances, there were conventions called, and sort of the sole mandate at the convention was that you better come out of this convention, delegates, with an initiative process, right? And so in a lot of initiative states, places like Oregon, California, even Nebraska, Michigan, Ohio, what you see is that the initiative is a deep structure within the state constitutional history and as well as within the institutions that sort of surround state government. The initiative is kind of deeply embedded and it's got this really sort of rich history that kind of supports it. Florida's history, as I understand it, is very, very different. So there's a push during the progressive era to get the initiative in Florida. The Senate, I think, passed a bill in like 1912, but it never actually became law. And so the initiative doesn't appear in Florida until the Revision Commission in 1967. And that was part of kind of a large scale, I guess they knew that I would be speaking and it's time for the party, I guess. So. It was part of a large-scale revision to the Florida Constitution that included a bunch of different stuff. And it wasn't really, as best I can tell, it wasn't really the result of this massive popular movement that had the initiative or even other forms of direct democracy as kind of the key agenda items for reform. That really wasn't what was going on with the 1966 Revision Commission. And so in the sort of transcripts of those debates that go on, there's very little discussion of the initiative. There's an understanding that there should be some sort of workaround amendment process that would avoid gridlock and avoid the legislature from being able to kind of bottleneck the process. And so the initiative was part of that solution. To the extent people got testy in those discussions, it seems like it was around how to compose these commissions that Justice Lawson was talking about and the way that they should be composed and who should be allowed to appoint people to those. That caused a lot of sort of discussion and grief during the debates in the commission. But it wasn't really sort of this deep commitment to methods of direct democracy that we see in a lot of the other initiative states. You know, as a result, so once
why would that matter? Just to jump in,
sure.
Like if there wasn't that commitment to direct democracy, does that matter? And is that something that we should think about as Floridians?
Yeah. So what does seem to have come out of the commission was a desire to deeply entrench that commission's document. So there was a lot of pride in what was produced. I think it was understood to have been sort of this watershed moment for upgrading and updating and modernizing the Florida Constitution. And so there came along with it, from what I can understand, and some of this might have been just rhetoric, it might have also reflected some entrenched political interests, but there was a lot of intensity, as best I can tell, to retain as much of that document's core structure as possible. And so direct democracy, I think then, and then even in the decades after that, represented a real threat to that political culture, whether it represented a political theory that kind of attends to the Florida Constitution, or whether it just represented an effort to retain the status quo. You see a real desire for the Florida Constitution in its sort of key features to be protected from dilution, from sort of ad hoc amendments, from this. The Supreme Court talks at various different points about a hodgepodge of things that could be added to it and could kind of undermine its coherence. And so, you know, the other feature of Florida's initiative that's different from other initiative states is that after it gets adopted, the history of it since then has basically been, as far as I can tell, it's been legislative attempts to constrain it and limit it, and judicial doctrine that has kind of come alongside and supported that effort, right? And so the story in Florida is really the initiative arrives, and then it's just struggling to stay there. If I had to pick an analogy, it's kind of like a freshwater fish that swam out to sea, right? Like, it could be worse. It could be a fish out of water, so it's kind of like limping along, but it's in an incredibly inhospitable environment compared to other states that have the initiative, that have sort of this deep commitment to it, and courts respect that, and they don't want to sort of see encroachment upon the initiative because they think that it's one of the deep structures of the document. So that's kind of how I see Florida's experience in the general theme. The other sort of point that I think is often lost from some of the comparative studies that have been done of the initiative, and that I think is important to this discussion, is that when we look at sort of ballot summaries and we look at the single subject rule across states, there's been some pretty rigorous empirical investigation of how effective those doctrines, lots of them are statutory, but there's been some backfilling from courts to make them pretty rigorous, especially in Florida. And the empirical research consistently finds that these two things are basically just a complete and utter farce, that voters do not rely on the ballot summary when they make decisions, right? That what they rely on are competitive campaigns from interest groups. That's what drives how voters decide, regardless of what's in the ballot measure. And the same thing goes for the single subject rule and for log rolling. Log rolling happens sometimes, sometimes it doesn't happen, but none of that really seems to matter. And the last finding that's really remarkable is that despite those, you might think, well, that means that the quality of referenda on initiatives is really low, that we're getting some really wacky results. And so let's just enforce these requirements just to keep things off the ballot, because the referenda results are crazy, they're unrepresentative, they're producing all kinds of bad law. And the opposite is actually true. One of the most reliable political processes we have for identifying the median voter on policy are initiative referenda. And the studies are really clear on this. Like, if you want to know what the median voter actually thinks on policy, present them with an initiative, a competitive initiative campaign, and that competitive campaign can be wildly complex. So some of the studies involved like really complex insurance initiatives in California. Back in the 80s, apparently auto insurance was like just crazy expensive in California. And so there was a year in the 80s when there were like five different competing multi-subject compound initiatives on the ballot. And some political scientists were like, this is the perfect laboratory to test what's going on. And so they conducted a whole bunch of exit poll interviews with voters, and they tracked sort of what was going on there. And they concluded that a lot of the voters had no idea what was actually going on the text of the amendment, but that the result of the referendum was incredibly accurate for what the median voter preferred for auto policy insurance changes, right? And this has been confirmed over and over and over again. And so all this leads me to believe that the single subject rule, ballot summary efforts, while they're in the statutes, they're really sort of coded in a proxy for something else that's going on. And I'm happy to talk more about that. The political science literature on how judges perform under the single subject rule is also not all that flattering. So there's some pretty compelling evidence that the rule has such little content that judges striving to make principal decisions mostly end up drawing upon their sort of priors and preferences on policy issues as an aggregate matter, just because the rule doesn't provide that content. And so, you know, I tend to be very sort of skeptical of what we're actually doing with single subject rule and also ballot summary efforts.
So what do you make of, you know, this is, we're just throwing out the agenda out the door, because now I'm asking you questions during your opening, but I can, so I will. So what do you make of the fact, of what you just said about how voters tend to not read the ballot summary, and they focus more on the ads that they might see maybe in the newspaper, or if anyone reads the newspaper anymore, or TV, you know, between Days of Our Lives, or whatever it is that they watch. What do you make of that? I mean, one of them is regulated and one of them is not. So if people are making decisions for these initiatives based on what they see in a commercial, and where someone could say anything versus what's being said, how do you feel about that?
Me?
You, yes, you.
I mean, I don't know how I feel about it. But I guess I would say that the studies that have been run suggest two things. The first is that that a competitive campaign driven by interest groups that have a desire to deceive voters still ends up producing incredibly reliable results in terms of the aggregate outcome of the vote. And in fact, the more competitive, the more nasty it is, the more likely we end up with an aggregate vote count that trends towards the median voter. Right? And now there's theories, those results are so unusual that the people have tried to figure out, well, how is it? It feels sort of wrong that when you have these really aggressive campaigns that would seem to be trying to trick voters, why is it that we end up with these aggregate results? And there's a bunch of different theories that try to explain it. But the results sort of consistently show where you ran into trouble is when you have non-competitive initiative campaigns. So when there's an initiative that nobody pays any attention to, nobody
cares,
spends any
yeah.
money to support, exactly, those results are really unreliable, right? And so that's kind of the...
Well, do you think people in a state like Florida have just reached the conclusion that whatever's on the ballot, someone's trying to trick me, it's a lie, it's a crapshoot, what's going to happen out of this? So do I feel like voting for it today or not? Doesn't matter. I'm getting tricked either way.
Yeah, I mean, so the other thing that comes out of the literature is that voters tend, the campaigns tend to be really accurate when there's a great variation between legislative policy and what's being talked about in the initiative campaigns. And so I think you might be right, but if there's a great misalignment between the median voter in a state and what legislatures are passing, that tends to drive voters to take action and try to sort through what they see to be this aggressive campaign.
As opposed to voting people out of office or
yeah,
whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Well, thank you for that. All right, Anastasia, you're next.
Hi, and thanks to Federal Society for having someone who's not a professor, not a judge, not an AG, not an SG, not even a Floridian, but instead a libertarian from California who spent her career suing the government. So I think it's nice that FedSoc always makes ideological diversity a priority, including even among people who are liberty-friendly, like me. But what I wanted to talk about is this panel was precipitated by a few pending Supreme Court cases relating to the single subject rule. And what I wanted to do was to step back from those cases and make sure that nobody makes up their mind about the single subject rule only because of those two cases, which involve some hot button issues. I want to avoid what Justice Scalia called abortion distortion in the law, where people see a case involving abortion, they know how they want it to come out, and they therefore make up their mind about what the law means. And I think if you step away from the facts of the pending cases, one having to do with abortion, another having to do with marijuana, and you look at how single subject rules are applied, you find that strict applications of single subject rules turn out to be really pure gamesmanship, in my view. In the context of citizen-led initiatives, and particularly citizen-led constitutional amendments, these rules, strict application of them at least, tend to thwart measures that are really intended to limit government most of the time, because that's what constitutions do, right? They tend to limit government actors compared to legislation, which limits all of us. So I wanted to give you a few examples. In the year 2000, there was a proposed constitutional amendment here in Florida, which would have banned racial preferences. And the court held that that proposed amendment violated the single subject rule because it would have contained three distinct classifications for where affirmative action was banned. That is, the proposed amendment applied to public education, public contracting, and public employment. And the court said those are three different things. And some people might be okay with affirmative action in public employment and not in public contracting. And now you're forcing people to choose all of them or none of them, and this is really unfair. You're thwarting democratic preferences. And so under this ironic rationale of not wanting to thwart democratic preferences, it took this democratically led initiative off of the ballot. And you know, I think we have to ask ourselves, does that seem like a fair application of the single subject rule? Is banning affirmative action in three places of the government really not just one subject? To give you another example, in 1994, there was an amendment that would have entitled property owners to damages via jury trial anytime the government reduces the value of their property. And the court invalidated that because it said that it substantially altered the functions of multiple branches of government. Not only did it limit the legislature, because now the legislature is going to have all sorts of liability if it engages in zoning, but also it limits the executive because they might be doing all sorts of functions that could take people's property rights away. And also, it transferred what was usually done in these administrative agencies and a lot of adjudication that way to the courts, because now you have a jury trial right. And so now you're affecting the legislative branch and the executive branch that way. And so this is not a single subject. That just seems not right to me. So after that, there's on the heels of that case, there was a proposed amendment that sought to repeal the single subject rule as applied to cases or amendments where people are trying to protect their property. So they said, okay, that didn't fly, got taken off the ballot. Let's exempt those types of amendments from the single subject rule. And the court said, you can't do that because it's not a single subject. So now you're trying to legislate on something that's not a single subject. And it invalidated that proposed amendment as well. And then one of my personal favorites was an initiative that sought to require voter approval for any new taxes. Now, prior to that amendment being proposed, the voters had passed an exception to the single subject rule for initiatives seeking to limit the power of government to raise revenue. So this should apply to that under that exception, right? There should be no single subject rule as applied to this initiative. But the court said that because this new proposed amendment affected not just new taxes, but also local government's ability to determine their budgets and the legislature's ability to fund education and complete their other obligations, the court said it fell outside of the exception. So here's the quote, let me read it to you. Since this initiative impacts several branches of government and several levels of government, it does not fall within the exemption to the single subject rule, and it violates the single subject rule. So it seems to me that under the reasoning, only things involving single subjects fall under the single subject exemption. You tend to get a lot of weird outcomes in these cases. To give you a couple from another states, because Florida is not the only one. I don't want to hate on Florida here and in Florida in front of a Florida audience.
We're a little aggressive about Florida in Florida, so it wouldn't
be
a good
idea. Hey, I'm just jealous. I wish I was a Floridian, but I'm stuck in California.
Everybody does. That's why our houses are all worth so much more money now.
Right. So to give you an example from Colorado, there was an initiative related to liquor licensing. It would have not only allowed grocery stores to sell liquor, but also allowed companies like Uber to deliver liquor. And the court said that that initiative violated the state single subject rule because legalization of wine sales at grocery stores and legalization of commercial alcohol delivery are two distinct and separate subjects. So, you know, I think in the end, what this rule is doing, what is it accomplishing? It's making it very difficult to limit taxation, to protect property rights, to impose liability on the government when it devalues your property, or to constrict government actors. Because again, that's what a constitution's for, and this is where your single subject rule applies. It applies to constitutional amendments. And so I think the question is, why do we have this rule? Let's not just ask how it applies or whether the court is right or wrong to get rid of the initiatives relating to abortion or marijuana, but let's step back and think about what are we trying to effectuate, and are these rules worth having in general?
All right, thank you. So now we're going to move into some questions. Some of these, y'all know, I've kind of let you know what to, you know, what you might be asked about, and so I'm going to start, Anastasia, where we left off with activism, but I'm also going to start where we left off last year. I think it was last year that we had Justice Bollock with us at this conference. Justice Bollock, of course, is a justice in Arizona on the Supreme Court, and he's written some wonderful things about interpretation of state constitutions, but before he became a judge, he wrote a book called David's Hammer. In that book, he talks about the word, or the phrase, judicial activist. And he talks about the fact that everybody who uses the word judicial activism is insulting someone, and it should be an insult, but everyone who uses that term doesn't mean it the same way. They're not referring to the same conduct. So, which is maybe by definition an ambiguous term, since it's a word that has more than one meaning. But in any event, he's talking about, he talks about, you and I know that the surest thing, as a former lawyer myself, and you know as lawyers, the surest thing is going to happen when a judge rules against you, and it was, especially if it was an issue that was close to your heart or that mattered to you or you really cared about your client, your instinct's going to be, I think that judge just didn't like me and wasn't going to let me win, and I think that she's an activist. So that's the, you know, the first category of activism is, she ruled against me. That definition doesn't work, and we all know why that is. But there's two others. There's the lawless judge, the judge who says, not on my watch, I'm not letting this happen. And then you have, he describes a different type of judge who's also an activist, and that judge is excessively humble. They're saying, well, you know, I'm just a judge, and I don't want to disrupt the legislature, or, you know, I don't want to get in the way of the governor, or whatever. They're excessively deferential. He says they're both bad, he says that they're both dangerous, and both are inconsistent with the constitutional republic. When you're looking at that, thinking about judicial activism and what does it mean, Anastasia, in the context of this type of process, what does it look like for someone to be a judicial activist in your mind? And we all know, I mean, unfortunately, I think it's probably a reality that however these two cases come out, there's probably going to be some folks in Florida that think that we have an activist Florida Supreme Court. And so we know we're going to hear it. Who's going to be right? And what would it take for someone to be right, whatever the outcome is here?
Yeah, I don't want to presume to paraphrase Justice Bullock, but I think what he's getting at in his book that you reference is that what people mean when they say judicial activists, I think, is that judges aren't doing their job. But we all have a different view of what a judge's job is. And so we have to be on the same page about that if we're going to have a meaningful conversation about whether somebody's a judicial activist or not. I think a judge's job is to meaningfully engage with the text, statutory or constitutional, even when that text brings up very difficult questions and there it has open-ended answers and nobody's quite sure. It's their duty to dig deep and to really meaningfully engage and not just defer to the other government actors who they exist to push back against, but rather to figure out what the real limits in the Constitution are. And so it's interesting because usually I'd be in the position of saying, yes, I'm all about judicial engagement. Who cares that single subject rules are hard? Because that's just judging. You know, you're not always going to like how the case comes out. You might disagree, but that doesn't mean that judging is a bad pursuit or illegitimate pursuit. You know, judging is a constant quest to get to pure logical reasoning to reach a just result. So why am I not saying that here? Why do I not like what's happening with single subject rules? Is because I don't think the single subject rule itself is very good. I'm all about judicial engagement when it's the Constitution because I think the Constitution is great. It's a classically liberal document that protects our individual rights. But what are we getting at with this single subject rule? It might make sense when you're talking about traditional legislation from the legislature. Yeah, I think omnibus legislation probably isn't a good idea. We live in a world where you hear politicians say things like, we need to pass the law to figure out what's in it. Yeah, sure, those people need to have single subject rules. But when it comes to citizen-led constitutional amendments, I don't think the same justifications apply. And what ends up happening is gamesmanship on behalf of the legislators who don't want to be constricted to get those citizen-led initiatives struck down.
Justice Lawson, what do you think?
So I think, well, first of all, the single subject requirement is not one imposed by the legislature. It was one that the people imposed themselves.
I mean, the Supreme Court can't get rid of that.
No, we can't.
I mean,
we can't get rid of that.
That's what they're stuck with.
And I think it does reflect an idea that with our Constitution, which should be about structure of government and not about policy. This is a republic. It's not a democracy. That protections need to be in the Constitution, and I think it's an important one. And in terms of the modern court, I can tell you that the modern court takes. I can't emphasize enough how seriously they take their job of looking at the text, including the text of the single subject rule that the people adopted in their constitution, and applying it as in the most unbiased way that they possibly can. And I've been in the room, I see it, I know these folks, and we are, of course, all human. But still, I don't know of a more dedicated group of smart people than we have on our modern court that are doing that job of doing what the people said they should do when they adopted their constitution in terms of making sure that wholesale changes that you could not possibly, I don't think, in terms of public debate, really understand the effect. And then once it gets in there, it is extraordinarily difficult to change again. So I think that in terms of your question, activism, it is putting the thumb on the scale one way or the other and not asking the question, okay, this is the text, this is what it says, single subject and matters directly connected where this with them, and does this fit within that parameters? If it doesn't, it goes. If it does, it stays whether we like it or not. And so that's the way it should
what be. About, you know, someone could say, I mean, the Supreme Court, there's precedent out there. It's almost like you're watching people discuss something right in front of you in some of these cases. There's discussions among justices saying, well, here we are. Is it activism to let something on a ballot that might be misleading, mm-hmm. or that might have more than one subject, or is it activism to keep it off? You know, you really are, to use a phrase, damned if you do, damned if you don't. I mean, somebody's going to think you're activist if you're the Florida Supreme Court. And I mean, I know you've been there. I don't remember anyone ever saying that about you. But I do think that they are, in this instance, damned if they do, damned if they don't. And ultimately, what they have to do is make a decision. People are going to call us a name no matter what. And in this instance, how do we define what is right and wrong under the law and our role as judges? And which one is right? Erring on the side of letting something in, that letting something on a ballot that might mislead people so that people don't think we're activists? Or erring on the side of saying, you know what, it's the Constitution has given us a responsibility and we have to vindicate it.
So the standard that's in the case law is that the measure and the ballot summary must be clearly and conclusively defective. And so that sort of lays it on the side of letting it in. I mean, the party's arguing that it shouldn't go on the ballot has to show that. And so there's that's in the case law. And there's some old precedent related to single subject and other things that really haven't been tested in the modern court. But the modern Florida Supreme Court, as I think most of you would know, has not been hesitant to overrule precedent if it was determined to be clearly erroneous. I mean, they're not, as long as there are no reliance interests and there wouldn't be in this context, then they're not hesitant to do so. And so, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if in the future there was some refinement of some of the precedent that you talked about in going back to the text of the single subject initiative.
Is there really a case, or what's a good case, if anyone knows, that there's a textual analysis of the single subject rule in Florida?
There is that I've seen. Yeah.
So why do you think that is?
I think because it hadn't been challenged in the modern era. It hasn't. But for a long time, I mean, we just looked at case law and we weren't textualists until Scalia and some others really started us down that trend. I mean, when I went to law school and even one of the new law clerks I had, I asked him to look at a statute and they came back with case law that described the statute without ever quoting the statute, which is the way I learned to do things. I mean, you know that. So it was taught like that. So I think that once bad precedent gets in the law, and until a very recent time in Florida, it was just going to stay there because there wasn't a lot of original thinking. There wasn't a thought to challenge it. Those are the standards, and so you just quote the standards over and over again.
So, kind of getting back to that idea between if there's not any sort of, because I couldn't find one, and I was just, you know, looking at it, in a sense. When you look at the Florida Supreme Court jurisprudence on the single subject rule, one could be left with the impression that you're watching like American Ninja Warriors. It's sort of like someone, you run down the gauntlet and somebody is just, are you gonna get taken off by this thing or this thing or this thing or this thing? And there's all these things that just appear out of nowhere. You know, they just kind of pop up and hit you in the face. And if you want to amend the Constitution, that seems problematic. You know, if Professor Marshfield, I know we talked about that you have some background in South Africa. We just got an au pair from South Africa, and I was talking to her about her form of government, and we were talking about ours and how ours works. And she said, you know, in South Africa, on paper, it should work very similar to what you've described. But there's a difference between how we actually operate as a government in South Africa and what the paper says. And that's a dangerous place to be, isn't it? That you have something that is supposed to be meaningful, but yet here we have American Ninja Warrior for Florida's and for Floridians, and that seems problematic. Solicitor General, do you have any comments on that?
Not on American Ninja Warrior.
Well, that's disappointing. I was hoping you would engage with me on that.
Yeah, I did have one thought on the activism thing and picking up where Justice Lawson left off. I mean, I think he gets it exactly right. Being a judge is to interpret a text fairly and not having a thumb on one side of the scale or the other. And in that regard, I think it's interesting that Justice Lawson mentioned the clearly and conclusively defective language from the case law, because I think that does put the thumb on the scale on one side or the other. That language does not appear in 101.161. It doesn't say it has to be clearly conclusively defective. It says that the language has to be clear and unambiguous. And in fact, not making any news here, I put this in my marijuana brief. I think that the clearly inconclusive language is wrong and should be receded from. The Florida Supreme Court should do that in order to read the text fairly. And part of, I think, how you approach that, and obviously I'm not sure this is something the Florida Supreme Court itself should necessarily consider, though, is that whether we think that the initiative process is a good thing or not. And if you believe in a Republican form of government, and if you believe, like the founders did, that who were well understood the dangers of direct democracy and deliberately created a representative form of government and did not want to create a direct democracy, I think how you view that and very much influences how you think of these requirements. I mean, the professor's comments about these things are basically, you know, we have a statute that sets these out in Florida, so that's his comments would not be a criticism on the way the Florida Supreme Court approaches things, a more argument about that Florida law should be changed, and whether or not it should be changed in that regard, I think, does depend on, you know, how you feel about direct democracy.
How do you feel about Randy Barnett's definition of ambiguous? First of all, what do you think the definition of ambiguous is? He says it's when a word means more than one thing.
Sure. Well, I think that vagueness is kind of a species of ambiguity. Vagueness just means when it's, you know, there's a sort of a fuzzy range of ambiguity, and ambiguity is more when there's sort of a defined range. That's how I would think about it. And either, I think, would be a problem on a ballot summary.
Well, he describes it is a word is ambiguous if it could mean more than one thing, and that you could apply rules of construction. You could look at it and run through Brian Garner and Justice Scalia's book and figure out what those words mean. You can look at history and figure out what those words mean, and you can, you know, identify based on the time that it was passed and figure out what the word means if it's ambiguous. Something that's vague, he thinks, means it could apply to a lot of different circumstances, and he separates the idea of vagueness and ambiguity and talks about the difference between interpreting and construction. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I that doesn't seem right to me. I mean, I think that you can have ambiguities that are just genuine ambiguities that you can't, it's like 50-50. I don't know, what does it mean this? Does it mean that? I don't know that some of this argument is going on in the Supreme Court case over the Chevrons. You know, are there ambiguities that just you can't resolve? And I think there probably are. Vagueness, I would think of vagueness as something like the Sherman Act, where you have unreasonable restraints of trade. What is unreasonable? Nobody knows. It's kind of vague, and we just figure it out through practice and common law and hiring economists.
Well, Randy Barnett may think that I completely butchered all that, so if he is, I'm sorry. I'm just a trial judge in Tampa. I just get stuff like that, you know, might not get it perfect. But that's very interesting and kind of fun to have that conversation with you, so thank you.
Sure.
So, Professor Marshfield, in the context of a citizen initiative case, it's kind of interesting that the, you know, we heard from Justice Lawson the five different ways that the Florida Constitution can be amended. Justice Lawson, of those five, which ones involve the Florida Supreme Court on the front end?
Just the initiative.
Just the initiative.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
That's the only time they get to weigh in and potentially say something like, well, listen, if we're going to apply, for example, textualism, here's what's going to happen. Is that what you mean? And otherwise, you have to put it, you do have to kind of borrow your quote, Anastasia, you do have to sort of put it in there to find out what it means, right? I mean, isn't that kind of the way this works? So it's also the only time that the Florida Supreme Court can review something almost like a role of a general counsel. So my husband runs a private equity fund. They buy businesses all the time, and I hear him on the phone negotiating the terms of a deal, and then I know that he goes and explains it to some lawyer somewhere, and they tell him whether it could work like that in the contract. And if so, whether or not the current contract that they're negotiating would work that way. They advise him before he enters into the contract to buy that business. But does the Florida Supreme Court perform that function? And Professor Marshfield, what if the Florida Supreme Court looks at what's on the ballot, or what they want to put on the ballot in a citizen initiative case and says, well, it doesn't work that way in our Constitution. You can't just put this in there. You can't graft that in without changing these other things. Can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, I mean, not nearly as well as Justice Lawson on the Florida side of it. I mean, that a preclearance approach is unique and unusual, right? So in most other initiative states, the way things end up in front of a state high court before an election is because the parties involved are reacting to something the executive branch has done in reviewing the initiative. And so it may get there, it may not get there, it may get there in time, it may not get there in time. It's not as systematized a process as we have in Florida. And you know, I infer from the process that we have in Florida that the Florida Supreme Court was expected to perform a very direct role in monitoring the ballot. I mean, I think a fair structural inference from the way Florida has set this up is that they're a gatekeeper to the ballot every single time. And that's consistent, I think, with the deeper commitments of the Florida Constitution to make sure that the Constitution doesn't run away with the initiative. And I think that's a commitment that is clear. And so even if it's not right on the face of the text, I think that's a tradition in Florida that is beneath the text that is still real and reflects some of how and why these cases shake out the way that they do. This is mildly responsive to your question, but also I think to some of the other comments that we've heard. And I guess I will just add that I think, you know, judges have incredibly hard jobs. And when we talk about activism, one of the things that maybe we don't often appreciate is that it comes with the suggestion that there is some conscious sort of like a subjective mindset that attenuates activism, right? And that may or may not be true, but there's also instances like the single subject rule where judges are asked to apply a law, and the law basically makes it impossible for them to do that in a way that is obviously rule-bound because the law has no content whatsoever. And I view the single subject rule as that way. It has no content, and also has hardly any history, right? These ideas, the rationales of like log rolling and voter confusion, those are very, very, very hard to find in the history of state constitutional law as the single subject rule was incorporated into the initiative. And I've looked through these convention debates, and it basically snuck in there as a hangover from legislative process. It wasn't given much thought along the way at all. And then courts were like, what do we do with this? It's in here. Our job is to apply it. We're acting in good faith. And so they do the next best thing, which is come up with these rationales, which are coherent and they make sense, but over time have been tested to just not be reliable. And I say all of that to say that I don't think the empirical literature makes any suggestion that judges aren't acting in good faith and aren't doing the absolute best that they can with the rules they've been given. I think what the literature says is the rules they've been given are so open-ended that what could we expect to happen when that's the rule that's given to them?
Right.
And I think one of the problems is that that when you look at whether something accurately describes the chief purpose or is misleading. You know, the subjective part of that is that if there's a significant number of people that would, to which something would be extremely important, then it would make a difference if it wasn't disclosed, right? And so you'd be leaving something out and misleading. I remember with the firearm case, we found it misleading because it had this undisclosed effect of making you get rid of your old, I mean, like the government could seize all these old weapons, but it didn't sound like that would happen at all. Now, the people who wanted the gun restriction, that would not have mattered to them at all. And so if the mindset, and people tend to think that everybody's like them, even though they know that it's not true subjectively. And so that's what happens subjectively is if it's something that's that you think, well, that shouldn't be important to anybody. I mean, just in the, and that's the way the public views it. Then you know, they look at an opinion that says it's misleading because it doesn't disclose this. And they say that's an activist court because obviously, you know, that's not something that would make a difference. I mean, it's like, what would make a difference? And I think what the court has to do, given the broad language that's difficult to apply, is really think about the reality of, okay, get out of my mind and get in everybody else's mind, and what is it that's gonna would rise to the level that it would make a difference? And sometimes, you know, it crystal clear to me that it would make a difference and there are other people that just can't see it at all. I mean, that's just human nature. But I think the court's role is to do this kind of subjective determination of what's going to make a difference in the voter's mind in order to determine whether a statement that says it does one thing is misleading when it leaves out this other thing.
Well, you know, in some ways, I wish I could have read all the briefs in these cases, but I didn't get a chance to read all of them. But it was interesting. You know, if you were to do a word cloud from all those, you know, someone could probably feed that into AI and do a word cloud and figure out what words is everybody talking about. You know, you know which words everybody's talking about, so you kind of know the words that are in contention. And perhaps that's an indication of where the problem lies, I assume. But I wanted to ask you this, Justice Lawson. Am I remembering correctly that you were a trial judge?
Yes.
You were a judge at every level, weren't you?
Only county court by special designation.
Okay.
But yeah.
Well, but you know, we'll let it slide. Okay. Just for a little bit. But when I was reading some of the briefs, one of the briefs that was filed in at least one of the cases was a brief that caught my eye simply because it caused me to wonder about the role of experts in ballot initiative cases. In my world in the trial court, you don't bring an expert in unless it's something that everybody doesn't know, right? Mm-hmm. So in these cases, is it a little risky to bring in an expert to try to tell the court what a word means? Doesn't that imply that that word's meaning is not something everyone knows?
Yes.
Okay.
Because you look at the ordinary meaning of words. So if it has a special connotation, I don't know what the relevance of that would be. So yes.
Okay. So there's one question I promised David I would ask, and since he asked me to be here, I want to make sure that I honor his request. Well, he's got a couple questions. So let me, multiple functions of government test. It derives from the single subject rule and says that where a proposed amendment changes more than one government function, it violates the single subject rule. That's in Evans versus Firestone. Does that derivation of the rule make sense? Or should the court recede from it? Who wants that one? Oh, I think it's Anastasia, you win.
Oh, good. Well, first, I do just want to echo something that Professor Marshfield said and make sure that I feel like my comments were taken as I meant them, which is that by bringing up all those examples of the applications of the single subject rule, it's certainly not to cast aspersions on anyone or to assume any nefarious intent or anything like that. I am a judicial supremacist. I love judicial engagement. I am all about judges engaging with difficult provisions. The problem I have with those cases isn't necessarily the outcomes. I don't even think they're necessarily wrong. It's just the rule itself I don't think is worth applying, and because it's open-ended, it's going to lead to very unsatisfactory results, results that people perceive as being politically motivated or unfair, what have you. But I want to make sure that I got that point across. In terms of, you know, the single subject rule, and the court has applied it by looking at whether a proposed constitutional amendment will affect different levels of government or different branches of government. I don't know where that came from. I don't see that as being part and parcel to the single subject rule. I think it's especially problematic now that we have, you know, in states as well as at the federal level, executive action that very often usurps the legislative role or vice versa. You know, everything nowadays is going to affect almost all three branches of government. And so even though the rule actually says that in order to satisfy the single subject rule, a proposed amendment should not change the way that those governments function. Instead, it has been applied, I think, in effect, to proposed amendments that merely affect different parts of government. And that's not a fair reading of the rule, and I think it's going to lead to some of these subjective results that nobody likes. I mean, you take a look at that affirmative action case, and that was part of the reasoning. The reasoning was, well, hey, this prevents the judiciary from crafting internal procedures that are related to race. It prevents the legislature from setting up commissions. It prevents the executive from doing these things at the executive level. So it's not the single subject. How does that not make it single subject? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But you know, I'm already skeptical of the rule to begin with. So take it for what it's worth.
Well, this is your opportunity to ask these fine people some questions about your Constitution and the process to amend it. So I want to make sure that I honor the request that we received to make sure you have time to ask questions. So if you have questions, we have a taker. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. After an amendment has been adopted by the Florida electors, what is the purpose of the ballot summary, if at all, or is it just a vestige that is to be discarded?
Its only purpose is to inform the voters of what they're voting on. So it doesn't have any effect after that, except that when challenges come in to a constitutional provision, or it comes to application of constitutional provision, and the question is, what's the original public meaning? Then the court's going to look back at the ballot summary at that point to say, well, what were the voters told it did? So it sort of resurrects and comes back to life in practice when you get an interpretive question about the Constitution or asking what the original public meaning was.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I just recently moved from California.
Welcome.
I swam the Colorado River to get away from communism. And I really am interested, Ms. Bowden and Professor. So California has so many initiatives, and the process is very different. If you put $2,000 down and you go to the Attorney General, you can basically, and you go out and raise the number of required signatures, you can get it on the ballot. It's not unusual to see, if you only see 12 initiatives in one election, that's probably a light year. So my question is, while the process here is different and seems a bit more restrictive, the California case is much more liberal and there's a lot more. And in many cases, it waters down all the initiatives. And there seems to be a propensity of, well, if there's an initiative, it must be good, so we'll vote for it. And it sounds to me as if it may be different in Florida. And I was just wondering if you could kind of give some context to other areas like California, where it is much more liberal to get initiatives on the ballot versus the way it is in Florida. We're looking at Florida and saying, well, it's very restrictive, but that may not necessarily be a bad thing. And it's different in that the Attorney General makes some decisions as opposed to the judicial system. So I'm just interested in your opinion.
Yeah, being on this panel has really made me rethink my pre-existing opinions about direct democracy, because even in California, where, as you say, we have a really robust initiative process, we have initiatives not just for constitutional amendments, but also for regular legislation, and you would think, it being California, that leads to all sorts of crazy, insane laws. But when you actually look at the initiatives that have passed in recent years, I was just going over them. They're actually, they tend to be not so bad. The crazy laws that come out of California come from the legislature, not the initiative. So the initiatives in recent years, so we had the ban on race preferences, have had it for a long time. They tried to repeal it by initiative recently, and it failed. We recently had property rights reform at the initiative level in California. Property rights reform. You know, there's been limits on tax increases by initiative. When California passed that terrible independent contractor law that turned everybody into a full-time employee, killed tons of jobs, made the side gig economy just impossible, how did we get an exemption through the initiative process? That's why Lyft and Uber didn't flee California, is because they were able through the initiative process to undo some of the terrible laws that were done at the legislative level. And then, you know, of course there are terrible ones that are proposed as initiative as well, but I've been pretty heartened by what I've seen in terms of what has failed in California. So there was that GMO labeling proposal in California that was defeated. So again, I think the lesson for me when looking at California compared to Florida is we don't have to be afraid about policing the initiative process as much as we thought, because at the amendment level, constitutional amendment level, those efforts are usually intended to restrict government. And then at the legislative level, it seems that usually the initiatives are reactions to bad government and not just independently crazy laws. So that's, you know, and that's been mind-blowing for me. I had to rethink what I thought about democracy in California after that.
And I'll just add quickly, because I think this is a common misconception. So the passage rate in California on initiatives is 38%. So 38% of the stuff that makes it to the ballot gets passed. In Florida, it's 80%. Right? And so this suggests to me there might be at least, it might be worth exploring whether we're under-inclusive in Florida. Maybe not, maybe it reflects this deep commitment to retaining the status quo, but the sort of aggregate data actually suggests that California is a great laboratory for demonstrating that the voters are really discerning, right? And that's borne out across not just individual sort of examples, but the data across those elections actually demonstrates some great discernment on behalf of voters.
Even a broken clock is right twice a day, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Excuse me. I have to say I came in a couple minutes late, but I hope this question was not. In my iterations of life, I was a professor also, Professor Marshfield, among other things. But anyway, here's my question. We have a single subject rule, obviously, for one section of the Florida Constitution. For the state, Florida, for legislation, there also is a single subject rule. We recently, in another one of the five methods of amending the Florida Constitution, the Constitutional Revision Commission went through that whole process, and there were 40 or 50 proposals, and they all came together. And there was a lot of consternation about whether they should have come together, and the commissioners just did it however they did it. And now there's a move afoot to repeal the Constitutional Revision Commission, perhaps in part of that. Although there is no textual discussion of the single subject rule in the case law that we know of, or you know of, or I know of, the question is that not empirical evidence in favor of keeping the single subject rule? And if we had to extend it, we could extend it maybe to the United States Congress and see how confused that situation is without it. Question mark.
Who wants that one?
I don't know if this just sidesteps the question because, you know, we're all attorneys here, right? So we'll just redirect how we want. But one thing that I find interesting about Florida is that the single subject rule is applied more strictly, because it's worded slightly differently, to citizen initiatives than it is to legislation. So there is the rule for both, and yet it's applied more strictly for the initiatives. And I think it should be just the opposite. But that's not answering the question, but it's an answer.
Okay, yes, sir.
Thank you. Professor Marshfield,
The notion I'd like to push back on a little bit is that the citizen initiatives somehow produce perhaps better legislation or more robust conceptions of what the median voter feels. As Exhibit A for that, I'm going to give you Amendment 10 from 2002 here in Florida. The ballot summary said as follows. No person shall confine a pig during pregnancy in a cage, crate, or other enclosure, or tether a pregnant pig on a farm so the pig is prevented from turning around freely. That became part of Florida's constitution. Is that the kind of, you know, does that reflect what you're talking about?
By the way, when you're from Florida, that's kind of the one.
And if you study state constitutions,
that and the light rail, you know.
You have to be able to talk about the pregnant pig amendment and then the ski slope width in New York. So there's an amendment in the New York Constitution that identifies exactly how wide the ski slopes are allowed to be in New York. I guess there's two things you could say. The first is that it's not perfect and sort of it's not going to capture sending a lot more stuff to the ballot is going to necessarily mean that we get some extra stuff that maybe isn't great, right? And so maybe it's not intended to stop or be a perfect sort of system. The other thing is though that on both the pregnant pig amendment and also on the ski slope effort, there's actually some really, really, really interesting political history to some of what's going on there. So I know the ski slope one better, but that was basically a grassroots popular movement based on conservation and development in the Adirondacks. And there was a lot of concern that the state had been captured by wealthy developers from Manhattan, and they were expanding out into the Adirondacks, and they were just gonna blow through public lands that were owned by the state. And then nobody would listen. Nobody in Albany would listen because it was too tight of a connection between all of that capital and the opportunities to develop in the Adirondacks. And so in the midst of a convention, there was a mobilization by a bunch of grassroots people who got to the delegates and they walked through the convention and they were like, this is gonna blow up one of our greatest public resources out in the Adirondacks. And people in the convention were not similarly situated to legislatures. They were one-time elected representatives. They didn't have all of the baggage of re-election and all of that lobbying effort. So they listened, and now we got this really obscure provision. But what it actually reflects to me is an effective use of the document to close that gap and that misalignment between recalcitrant officials and what the sort of majority would want in their sort of policy. I'm sure we're running out of time, but I would also just add that the idea that Madison determined the form of constitutional democracy that we live under is also something we need to question, because even since the time of Madison, state constitutions have been populist documents, right? The Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776, even the Massachusetts Constitution that came out of this period where these ideas of Republican government were much more dominant than direct democracy reflects a greater commitment to direct democracy than our federal document does. And so I just think that we really need to rethink why we're wedded to this notion that these documents should be revered to the extent where the people can't have access to them.
Do you disagree with the statement I read somewhere that someone said, amending the Constitution is hard because it's supposed to be hard? Do you think it should be hard?
No, I think the standard should be that the Constitution should be amended as necessary to ensure the faithfulness of government to the people. If that means that we can design processes that truly tap the people and ensure that government doesn't. Now, this is I'm espousing this view as somebody that's sort of understands it's not the dominant perspective, but that should be the gauge that we calibrate amendment to. It shouldn't be to some sort of reverence for a moment in time when the document presumably identified and constructed the perfect form of government.
Anybody else want to weigh on that?
I believe in our Republican form of government, and I think that it should be hard to amend a constitution. I think that it should be structural and protect basic rights, and that we should leave it to the elective Republican process to enact social policy.
Are there reasons for that related to process? For example, that you look through the law and there's just all over the law, there's examples of how we value process because we have process that yields good results. For example, the legislative process is difficult, but it requires debate. It requires, people go through a process where they amend things because they can't get enough votes. You know, is that part of what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Solicitor General.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that wasn't aware of the stats on passage of amendments, but it does seem that a lot of the initiatives that have been passed in Florida are really just ways of evading the legislative process. They're basically forms of policy, like banning greyhound racing and, you know, approving medical marijuana and all this stuff, and, you know, codifying Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act into the Florida Constitution. All these things are not really things you normally see in the Constitution, and they're more just ways of evading the people's representatives. And I think the Constitution, the federal Constitution, properly sets up a mixed form of government, not a direct democracy. And the more we have these initiatives, the more we move away from that.
So final question, I don't think we have anybody else. In the cases, there's discussion about, again, kind of returning to this issue that I think is significant about how to deciding how to decide one of these cases, and do we hope that the Florida Supreme Court approaches its job with humility or with vigor or something else? And so I wanted to put that be our last question, and I guess I'll start with Justice Lawson because you've done it, and then we'll go Solicitor General Professor Marshfield and Anastasia, and then we'll be done.
Both. I mean, a judge should always approach the job with the humility of knowing that they're a guardian of the Constitution and that their job is to interpret and apply the law fairly and evenly, and with the vigor and rigor and courage to make those decisions irrespective of the consequences in terms of public opinion and whatever the legislature might think about them or anything like that. So it takes vigor to do the role that you have to perform, but it also does take humility.
Well, and I think I'm guessing by the choice of words, for example, the humility as a defender. I mean, if I've got somebody defending me, the thing I want is vigor in the defense as opposed to humility in the defense. It seems like you've in this posture, you believe that doing the job well requires a vigorous defense of the job. Okay,
yes.
Solicitor General.
I hope they read the text fairly. I also hope that nobody calls them activists if they strike down the ballot summary as misleading, because I think that's democracy reinforcing, because that's just if it really is misleading. So just let's argue about whether it is or is not misleading and not whether that's activist, because I think that to leave a ballot measure on that is misleading is thwarting the will of the voters and making it harder for the will of the voters to come through, which is the purpose, presumably the purpose of the initiative process.
Well, it's interesting. You clerked for Justice Thomas, right?
Yes.
Well, I did not clerk for Justice Thomas, but I did meet him once, and I met him, I think, the day after the Obamacare oral arguments. And he said that he hoped that whatever happened in those cases, that people would understand that if you attack the institution of the Supreme Court, there is no plan B. If you tear it down, we don't have anything else. And so I think what you're saying is it's best for everyone, no matter how passionately you feel about these topics, it's best for everyone to remember the Florida Supreme Court's what we got, whether we like what they give us or not. It's what we have, and we should be respectful of it, recognizing there isn't a plan B. Is that what you're saying?
Sure, that's part of it. I mean, I
think
it's fine to criticize the Florida Supreme Court. Like, the only point I was trying to make, you know, not everybody can disagree with their reasoning, but the only point I was trying to make was just that how activism fits in there, whether you or not it is activists, you have to understand that there's a democracy reinforcing value in policing the ballot language vigorously. That's the only point I was trying to make.
Okay. All right, Professor Marshfield.
I probably wouldn't feel comfortable answering that question in that broad of a scope. I would just say in the single subject rule context, I would frame it as one where I would hope judges would react to the lack of content that's inherent in the rule and then move from there to think about what sort of standard they would want to structure when they're faced with a rule that has very, very little content. And in the single subject rule context, I personally, you know, looking at that and looking at the quality of outcomes from voters, would like to see greater deference to voters under a rule with very little content. But that's.
And your thought on that is, I think, because it's their constitution and it's their contract with the government, and so if they want it, then they should have it. Is that the kind of the philosophy
you
have?
I think so. I mean, in the Florida context, I'm very compelled by this idea that amendments that mess around with other parts of the Constitution and other branches of government, I actually think that's maybe the more coherent rationale that the Florida Supreme Court has articulated for why it's vigorously enforcing single subject, and so I think that's the competing side of this.
Are you talking about that kind of as the context of like internal inconsistencies in the Constitution and guarding against internal inconsistency? When you have the opportunity, don't let it happen?
Yes, I think that's okay. A unique part of Florida jurisprudence, and it reflects their commitment to protecting the document.
And you're kind of talking about the Fine case when mm-hmm. you say that. Okay. All right. Anastasia?
Yeah, I guess I would say I would neither want judges to be, let's say, vigorous or humble, but rather just to give effect to the text. And the problem is this text is very vague. And so, you know, I think it's more important to me that Floridians consider why they have this rule, whether it's worth keeping. And to the extent that some are worried that we're just putting weird things into our constitution through the initiative process, well, you can always create an initiative process for straight legislation rather than just constitutional amendments. Florida is one of only three states of all those that have initiative processes that limits the initiative process to constitutional amendments. So that's why you're going to get funny legislation trying to get, or funny initiatives trying to go into the Constitution. But that's not a foregone conclusion. You can always make a new initiative process.
I don't think that we could have asked for a better panel. You all have been so interesting to listen to. Thank you very much. So that concludes our panel. Have a great night and a great dinner.